explicitly endangered the success of a private project. Escape. For the prisoner was not as unconcerned as he appeared to be, or as resigned. He intended taking every step possible to avoid a ride on the big swing. Convinced that such a ceremony would be the outcome of any trial, certainly any trial held in the state of Kansas, he had decided to bust jail, grab a car and raise dust. But first he must have a weapon, and over a period of weeks he'd been making one. A shiv, an instrument very like an ice pick, something that would fit with lethal niceness between the shoulder blades of Under-Sheriff Meyer. The weapon's components, a piece of wood and a length of hard wire, were originally part of a toilet brush he'd confiscated, dismantled, and hidden under his mattress. Late at night, when the only noises were snores and coughs and the mournful whistle wailings of Santa Fe trains rumbling through the darkened town, he honed the wire against the cell's concrete floor. And while he worked, he schemed. Once, the first winter after he had finished high school, Hickok had hitchhiked across Kansas and Colorado. This was when I was looking for a job. Well, I was riding in a truck, and the driver, me and him got into a little argument. No reason exactly, but he beat up on me. Shoved me out. Just left me there. High the hell up in the Rockies. It was sleeting like, and I walked miles, my nose bleeding like 15 pigs. Then I come to a bunch of cabins on a wooded slope. Summer cabins, all locked up and empty that time of year. And I broke into one of them. There was firewood and canned goods, even some whiskey. I laid up there over a week, and it was one of the best times I ever knew. Despite the fact my nose hurt so and my eyes were green and yellow. And when the snow stopped, the sun came out. You never saw such skies. Like Mexico, if Mexico was in a cold climate. I hunted through the other cabins and found some smoked hams and a radio and a rifle. It was great. Out all day with a gun, with the sun in my face. Boy, I felt good. I felt like Tarzan. And every night I ate beans and fried ham and rolled up in a blanket by the fire and fell asleep listening to music on the radio. Nobody came near the place. I bet I could have stayed till spring. If the escape succeeded, that was the course Dick had determined upon, to head for the Colorado Mountains and find there a cabin where he could hide until spring. Alone, of course. Perry's future did not concern him. The prospect of so idyllic an interim added to the inspired stealth with which he wetted his wire, filed it to a limber stiletto fineness. Thursday, 10 March. Sheriff had a shakeout. Searched through all the cells and found a shiv tucked under D's mattress. Wonder what he had in mind. Smile. Not that Perry really considered it a smiling matter, for Dick, flourishing a dangerous weapon, could have played a decisive role in plans he himself was forming. As the weeks went by, he had become familiar with life on Courthouse Square, its habitués and their habits. The cats, for example. The two thin gray toms who appeared with every twilight and prowled the square, stopping to examine the cars parked around its periphery. Behavior puzzling to him until Mrs. Meyer explained that the cats were hunting for dead birds caught in the vehicle's engine grills. Thereafter, it pained him to watch their maneuvers. Because most of my life, I've done what they're doing. The equivalent. And there was one man of whom Perry had grown especially aware. A robust, upright gentleman with hair like a gray and silver skullcap. His face, filled out, firm-jawed, was somewhat cantankerous in repose. The mouth down-curved, the eyes downcast as though in mirthless reverie. A picture of unsparing sternness. And yet this was at least a partially inaccurate impression, for now and again the prisoner glimpsed him as he paused to talk to other men, joke with them and laugh, and then he seemed carefree, jovial, generous. the kind of person who might see the human side. An important attribute, for the man was Roland H. Tate, judge of the 32nd Judicial District, the jurist who would preside at the trial of the state of Kansas versus Smith and Hickok. Tate, as Perry soon learned, was an old and awesome name in western Kansas. The judge was rich. He raised horses. He owned much land, and his wife was said to be very beautiful. He was the father of two sons, but the younger had died, a tragedy that greatly affected the parents and led them to adopt a small boy who had appeared in court as an abandoned, homeless child. "He sounds soft-hearted to me," Perry once said to Mrs. Meyer. "Maybe he'll give us a break." But that was not what Perry really believed. He believed what he'd written Don Cullivan, with whom he now corresponded regularly. His crime was unforgivable, and he fully expected to climb those 13 steps. However, he was not altogether without hope, for he too had plotted an escape. It depended upon a pair of young men that he had often observed observing him. One was red-haired, the other dark. Sometimes, standing in the square under the tree that touched the cell window, they smiled and signaled to him. Or so he imagined. Nothing was ever said, and always, after perhaps a minute, they drifted away. But the prisoner had convinced himself that the young men, possibly motivated by a desire for adventure, meant to help him escape. Accordingly, he drew a map of the square, indicating the points at which a getaway car could most advantageously be stationed. Beneath the map, he wrote, "I need a hacksaw blade, 5 inches. Nothing else. But do you realize the consequences if you get caught? Nod your head if you do. It could mean a long stretch in prison. Or you might get killed. All for someone you don't know. You better think it over. Seriously. Besides, how do I know I can trust you? How do I know it isn't a trick to get me out there and gun me down? What about Hickok? All preparations must include him." Perry kept this document on his desk, wadded and ready to drop out the window the next time the young men appeared. But they never did. He never saw them again. Eventually, he wondered if perhaps he had invented them. A notion that he might not be normal, maybe insane, had troubled him, even when I was little, and my sisters laughed because I liked moonlight, to hide in the shadows and watch the moon. Phantoms or not, he ceased to think of the young men. Another method of escape, suicide, replaced them in his musings. And despite the jailer's precautions, no mirror, no belt or tie or shoelaces, he had devised a way to do it. For he also was furnished with a ceiling bulb that burned eternally, but unlike Hickok, he had in his cell a broom, and by pressing the broom brush against the bulb, he could unscrew it. One night, he dreamed that he'd unscrewed the bulb, broken it, and with the broken glass cut his wrists and ankles. "I felt all breath and light leaving me," he said in a subsequent description of his sensations. "The walls of the cell fell away. The sky came down. I saw the big yellow bird." Throughout his life, as a child, poor and meanly treated, as a footloose youth, as an imprisoned man, the yellow bird, huge and parrot-faced, had soared across Perry's dreams, an avenging angel who savaged his enemies, or, as now, rescued him in moments of mortal danger. "She lifted me. I could have been light as a mouse. We went up, up. I could see the square below. Men running, yelling, the sheriff shooting at us. Everybody sore as hell because I was free. I was flying. I was better than any of them." The trial was scheduled to start on March 22, 1960. In the weeks preceding that date, the defense attorneys frequently consulted the defendants. The advisability of requesting a change of venue was discussed, but as the elderly Mr. Fleming warned his client, it wouldn't matter where in Kansas the trial was held. Sentiments the same all over the state. "We're probably better off in Garden City. This is a religious community. 11,000 population and 22 churches. And most of the ministers are opposed to capital punishment. Say it's immoral, unchristian. Even the Reverend Cohen, the Clutter's own minister and a close friend of the family, he's been preaching against the death penalty in this very case. Remember, all we can hope is to save your lives. I think we stand as good a chance here as anywhere. Soon after the original arraignment of Smith and Hickok, their advocates appeared before Judge Tate to argue a motion urging comprehensive psychiatric examinations for the accused. Specifically, the court was asked to permit the state hospital in Larned, Kansas, a mental institution with maximum security facilities, to take custody of the prisoners for the purpose of ascertaining whether either or both were insane, imbeciles, or idiots, unable to comprehend their position and aid in their defense. Larned is 100 miles east of Garden City. Hickok's attorney, Harrison Smith, informed the court that he had driven there the previous day and conferred with several of the hospital's staff. "We have no qualified psychiatrists in our own community. In fact, Larned is the only place within a radius of 225 miles where you'll find such men. Doctors trained to make serious psychiatric evaluations. That takes time. 4 to 8 weeks. But the personnel with whom I discussed the matter said they were willing to start work at once. And of course, being a state institution, it won't cost the county a nickel." This plan was opposed by the special assistant prosecuting attorney, Logan Green, who, certain that temporary insanity was the defense his antagonists would attempt to sustain in the forthcoming trial, feared that the ultimate outcome of the proposal would be, as he predicted in private conversation, the appearance on the witness stand of a pack of head healers sympathetic to the defendants. "Those fellas, they're always crying over the killers. Never a thought for the victims." Short, pugnacious, a Kentuckian by birth, Green began by pointing out to the court that Kansas law, in regard to sanity, adheres to the McNaughton Rule, the ancient British importation which contends that if the accused knew the nature of his act and knew it was wrong, then he is mentally competent and responsible for his actions. "Furthermore," said Green, "there was nothing in the Kansas statutes indicating that the physicians chosen to determine a defendant's mental condition must be of any particular qualification. Just plain doctors. Medical doctors in general practice. That's all the law requires. We have sanity hearings in this county every year for the purpose of committing people to the institution. We never call anybody in from Larned or psychiatric institutions of any kind. Our own local physicians attend to the matter. It's no great job to find whether a man is insane or an idiot or an imbecile. It is entirely unnecessary, a waste of time to send the defendants to Larned." In rebuttal, Counsel Smith suggested that the present situation was far graver than a simple sanity hearing in probate court. Two lives are at stake. "Whatever their crime, these men are entitled to examination by persons of training and experience. Psychiatry," he added, pleading with the judge quite directly, "has matured rapidly in the past 20 years. The federal courts are beginning to keep in tune with this science as related to people charged with criminal offenses. It just seems to me we have a golden opportunity to face up to the new concepts in this field." It was an opportunity the judge preferred to reject, for as a fellow jurist once remarked, "Tate is what you might call a law book lawyer. He never experiments. He goes strictly by the text." But the same critic also said of him, "If I were innocent, he's the first man I'd want on the bench. If I was guilty, the last." Judge Tate did not entirely deny the motion. Rather, he did exactly all the law demanded by appointing a commission of 3 Garden City doctors and directing them to pronounce a verdict upon the mental capacities of the prisoners. In due course, the medical trio met the accused, and, after an hour or so of conversational prying, announced that neither man suffered from any mental disorder. When told of their diagnosis, Perry Smith said, "How would they know? They just wanted to be entertained. Hear all the morbid details from the killer's own terrible lips. Oh, their eyes were shining. Hickok's attorney was also angry. Once more, he traveled to Larned State Hospital, where he appealed for the unpaid services of a psychiatrist willing to go to Garden City and interview the defendants. The one man who volunteered, Dr. W. Mitchell Jones, was exceptionally competent. Not yet 30, a sophisticated specialist in criminal psychology and the criminally insane, who had worked and studied in Europe and the United States, he agreed to examine Smith and Hickok and, should his findings warrant it, testify in their behalf. On the morning of March 14th, counsels for the defense again stood before Judge Tate, there on this occasion to plead for a postponement of the trial, which was then 8 days distant. Two reasons were given. The first was that a most material witness, Hickok's father, was at present too ill to testify. The second was a subtler matter. During the past week, a boldly lettered notice had begun to appear in the town's shop windows, and in banks, restaurants, and at the railroad station. And it read, H.W. Clutter Estate Auction Sale, 21 March 1960, at the Clutter Homestead. Now, said Harrison Smith, addressing the bench, I realize it is almost impossible to prove prejudice. But this sale, an auction of the victim's estate, occurs 1 week from today. In other words, the very day before the trial begins. Whether that's prejudicial to the defendants, I'm not able to state. But these signs, coupled with newspaper advertisements and advertisements on the radio, will be a constant reminder to every citizen in the community, among whom 150 have been called as prospective jurors. Judge Tate was not impressed. He denied the motion without comment. Earlier in the year, Mr. Clutter's Japanese neighbor, Hideo Ashida, had auctioned his farming equipment and moved to Nebraska. The Ashida sale, which was considered a success, attracted not quite 100 customers. Slightly more than 5,000 people attended the Clutter auction. Holcomb's citizenry expected an unusual turnout. The ladies' circle of the Holcomb Community Church had converted one of the Clutter barns into a cafeteria stocked with 200 homemade pies, 250 pounds of hamburger meat, and 60 pounds of sliced ham. But no one was prepared for the largest auction crowd in the history of western Kansas. Cars converged on Holcomb from half the counties in the state, and from Oklahoma, Colorado, Texas, Nebraska. They came bumper to bumper down the lane leading to River Valley Farm. It was the first time the public had been permitted to visit the Clutter place since the discovery of the murders, a circumstance which explained the presence of perhaps a third of the immense congregation, those who had come out of curiosity. And, of course, the weather was an aid to attendance, for by mid-March, winter's high snows have dissolved, and the earth beneath, thoroughly thawed, has emerged as acre upon acre of ankle-deep mud. There is not much a farmer can do until the ground hardens. Land's so wet and nasty, said Mrs. Bill Ramsey, the wife of a farmer. Can't work nohow. We figured we might as well drive on out to the sale. Actually, it was a beautiful day. Spring. Though mud abounded underfoot, the sun, so long shrouded by snow and cloud, seemed an object freshly made, and the trees, Mr. Clutter's orchard of pear and apple trees, the elms shading the lane, were lightly veiled in a haze of virginal green. The fine lawn surrounding the Clutter house was also newly green, and trespassers upon it, women anxious to have a closer look at the uninhabited home, crept across the grass and peered through the windows as though hopeful but fearful of discerning, in the gloom beyond the pleasant flower-print curtains, grim apparitions. Shouting, the auctioneer praised his wares. Tractors, trucks, wheelbarrows, nail kegs and sledgehammers and unused lumber, milk buckets, branding irons, horses, horseshoes, everything needed to run a ranch from rope and harness to sheep dip and tin washtubs. It was the prospect of buying this merchandise at bargain prices that had lured most of the crowd. But the hands of bidders flickered shyly. work-roughened hands timid of parting with hard-earned cash. Yet nothing went unsold. There was even someone keen to acquire a bunch of rusty keys, and a youthful cowboy sporting pale yellow boots bought Kenyon Clutter's coyote wagon, the dilapidated vehicle the dead boy had used to harass coyotes, chase them on moonlit nights. The stagehands, the men who hauled the smaller items on and off the auctioneer's podium, were Paul Helm, Vic Ersick, and Alfred Stokeline, each of them an old, still faithful employee of the late Herbert W. Clutter. Assisting at the disposal of his possessions was their final service, for today was their last day at River Valley Farm. The property had been leased to an Oklahoma rancher, and henceforward strangers would live and work there. As the auction progressed, and Mr. Clutter's worldly domain dwindled, gradually vanished, Paul Helm, remembering the burial of the murdered family, said, "It's like a second funeral." The last thing to go was the contents of the livestock corral, mostly horses, including Nancy's horse, Big Fat Babe, who was much beyond her prime. It was late afternoon, school was out, and several schoolmates of Nancy's were among the spectators when bidding on the horse began. Susan Kidwell was there. Sue, who had adopted another of Nancy's orphaned pets, a cat, wished she could give Babe a home, for she loved the old horse and knew how much Nancy had loved her. The two girls had often gone riding together aboard Babe's wide back, jogged through the wheat fields on hot summer evenings down to the river and into the water, the mare wading against the current until, as Sue once described it, the three of us were cool as fish. But Sue had no place to keep a horse. "I hear 50. 65. 70. The bidding was laggardly. Nobody seemed really to want Babe, and the man who got her, a Mennonite farmer who said he might use her for plowing, paid $75. As he led her out of the corral, Sue Kidwell ran forward. She raised her hand as though to wave goodbye, but instead clasped it over her mouth. The Garden City Telegram, on the eve of the trial's start, printed the following editorial. "Some may think the eyes of the entire nation are on Garden City during this sensational murder trial, but they are not. Even 100 miles west of here in Colorado, few persons are even acquainted with the case, other than just remembering some members of a prominent family were slain. This is a sad commentary on the state of crime in our nation. Since the 4 members of the Clutter family were killed last fall, several other such multiple murders have occurred in various parts of the country. Just during the few days leading up to this trial, at least 3 mass murder cases broke into the headlines. As a result, this crime and trial are just one of many such cases people have read about and forgotten." Although the eyes of the nation were not upon them, the demeanor of the event's main participants, from the court recorder to the judge himself, was markedly self-aware on the morning of the court's first convening. All 4 of the lawyers sported new suits. The new shoes of the big-footed county attorney creaked and squealed with every step. Hickok, too, was sharply dressed in clothes provided by his parents. Trim blue serge trousers, a white shirt, a narrow dark blue tie. Only Perry Smith, who owned neither jacket nor tie, seemed sartorially misplaced. Wearing an open-necked shirt, borrowed from Mr. Meyer, and blue jeans rolled up at the cuffs, he looked as lonely and inappropriate as a seagull in a wheat field. The courtroom, an unpretentious chamber situated on the 3rd floor of the Finney County Courthouse, has dull white walls and furnishings of darkly varnished wood. The spectator benches can seat perhaps 160 persons. On Tuesday morning, March 22nd, the benches were occupied exclusively by the all-male venire of Finney County residents from which a jury was to be selected. Not many of the summoned citizenry seemed anxious to serve. One potential juror, in conversation with another, said, "They can't use me. I can't hear well enough." To which his friend, after a bit of sly reflection, replied, "Come to think of it, my hearing's not too good either." And it was generally thought that the choosing of the jury would take several days. As it turned out, The process was completed within 4 hours. Moreover, the jury, including two alternative members, was extracted from the first 44 candidates. 7 were rejected on peremptory challenge by the defense, and 3 were excused at the request of the prosecution. Another 20 won dismissal either because they opposed capital punishment or because they admitted to having already formed a firm opinion regarding the guilt of the defendants. The 14 men ultimately elected consisted of half a dozen farmers, a pharmacist, a nursery manager, an airport employee, a well driller, 2 salesmen, a machinist, and the manager of Ray's bowling alley. They were all family men. Several had 5 children or more, and were seriously affiliated with one or another of the local churches. During the voir dire examination, 4 of them told the court that they had been personally, though not intimately, acquainted with Mr. Clutter. But upon further questioning, each said he did not feel this circumstance would hinder his ability to reach an impartial verdict. The airport employee, a middle-aged man named N.L. Dunnan, said, when asked his opinion of capital punishment, "Ordinarily I'm against it. But in this case, no." A declaration which, to some who heard it, seemed clearly indicative of prejudice. Dunnan was nevertheless accepted as a juror. The defendants were inattentive observers of the voir dire proceedings. The previous day, Dr. Jones, the psychiatrist who had volunteered to examine them, had interviewed them separately for approximately 2 hours. At the end of the interviews, he had suggested that they each write for him an autobiographical statement, and it was the act of composing these statements that occupied the accused throughout the hours spent assembling a jury. Seated at opposite ends of their counsel's table, Hickok worked with a pen and Smith with a pencil. Smith wrote, "I was born Perry Edward Smith, October 27, 1928, in Huntington, Elko County, Nevada, which is situated way out in the boondocks, so to speak. I recall that in 1929, our family had ventured to Juneau, Alaska. In my family were my brother, Tex Jr. He later changed his name to James because of the ridicule of the name Tex, and also, I believe, he hated my father in his early years. My mother's doing. My sister Fern, she also changed her name to Joy. My sister Barbara, and myself. In Juneau, my father was making bootleg hooch. I believe it was during this period my mother became acquainted with alcohol. Mom and Dad began having quarrels. I remember my mother was entertaining some sailors while my father was away. When he came home, a fight ensued, and my father, after a violent struggle, threw the sailors out and proceeded to beat my mother. I was frightfully scared. In fact, all us children were terrified, crying. I was scared because I thought my father was going to hurt me, also because he was beating my mother. I really didn't understand why he was beating her, but I felt she must have done something dreadfully wrong. The next thing I can vaguely recall is living in Fort Bragg, California. My brother had been presented a BB gun. He had shot a hummingbird, and after he had shot it, he was sorry. I asked him to let me shoot the BB gun. He pushed me away, telling me I was too small. It made me so mad I started to cry. After I finished crying, my anger mounted again, and during the evening when the BB gun was behind the chair my brother was sitting in, I grabbed it and held it to my brother's ear and hollered, "Bang!" My father, or mother, beat me and made me apologize. My brother used to shoot at a big white horse ridden by a neighbor who went by our place on his way to town. The neighbor caught my brother and I hiding in the bushes and took us to Dad, and we got a beating, and brother had his BB gun taken away, and I was glad he had his gun taken away. This is about all I remember when we lived in Fort Bragg. Oh, we kids used to jump from a hayloft, holding an umbrella, onto a pile of hay on the ground. My next recollection is several years later when we were living in California? Nevada? I recall a very odious episode between my mother and a Negro. We children slept on a porch in the summertime. One of our beds was directly under my mother and father's room. Every one of us kids had taken a good look through the partly open curtain and seen what was going on. Dad had hired a Negro, Sam, to do odd jobs around the farm, or ranch, while he was working somewhere down the road. He used to come home late in the evening in his Model A truck. I do not recall the chain of events, but assumed Dad had known or suspected what was happening. It ended in a separation between Mom and Dad, and Mom took us kids to San Francisco. She ran off with Dad's truck and all of the many souvenirs he brought from Alaska. I believe this was in 1935. In Frisco, I was continuously in trouble. I had started to run around with a gang, all of which were older than myself. My mother was always drunk, never in a fit condition to properly provide and care for us. I ran as free and wild as a coyote. There was no rule or discipline, or anyone to show me right from wrong. I came and went as I pleased, until my first encounter with trouble. I was in and out of detention homes many, many times for running away from home and stealing. I remember one place I was sent to. I had weak kidneys and wet the bed every night. This was very humiliating to me, but I couldn't control myself. I was very severely beaten by the cottage mistress, who had called me names and made fun of me in front of all the boys. She used to come around at all hours of the night to see if I wet the bed. She would throw back the covers and furiously beat me with a large black leather belt, pull me out of bed by my hair and drag me to the bathroom and throw me in the tub and turn the cold water on and tell me to wash myself and the sheets. Every night was a nightmare. Later on, she thought it was very funny to put some kind of ointment on my penis. This was almost unbearable. It burned something terrible. She was later discharged from her job. But this never changed my mind about her and what I wished I could have done to her and all the people who made fun of me. Then, because Dr. Jones had told him he must have the statement that very afternoon, Smith skipped forward to early adolescence and the years he and his father had lived together, the two of them wandering all over the West and Far West, prospecting, trapping, doing odd jobs. I loved my father, but there were times when this love and affection I had for him drained from my heart like wasted water. Whenever he would not try to understand my problems, give me a little consideration and voice and responsibility, I had to get away from him. When I was 16, I joined the Merchant Marine. In 1948, I joined the Army. The recruiting officer gave me a break and upped my test. From this time on, I started to realize the importance of an education. This only added to the hatred and bitterness I held for others. I began to get into fights. I threw a Japanese policeman off a bridge into the water. I was court-martialed for demolishing a Japanese cafe. I was court-martialed again in Kyoto, Japan, for stealing a Japanese taxicab. I was in the Army almost 4 years. I had many violent outbursts of anger while I served time in Japan and Korea. I was in Korea 15 months, was rotated and sent back to the States, and was given special recognition as being the first Korean vet to come back to the territory of Alaska. Big write-up, picture in paper, paid trip to Alaska by air, all the trimmings. I finished my Army service in Fort Lewis, Washington. Smith's pencil sped almost indecipherably as he hurried toward more recent history. The motorcycle accident that had crippled him, the burglary in Phillipsburg, Kansas, that had led to his first prison sentence. I was sentenced to 5 to 10 years for grand larceny, burglary, and jailbreak. I felt I was very unjustly dealt with. I became very bitter while I was in prison. Upon my release, I was supposed to go to Alaska with my father. I didn't go. I worked for a while in Nevada and Idaho, went to Las Vegas and continued to Kansas, where got into the situation I'm in now. No time for more. He signed his name and added a postscript. Would like to speak to you again. There's much I haven't said that may interest you. I have always felt a remarkable exhilaration being among people with a purpose and a sense of dedication to carry out that purpose. I felt this about you in your presence. Hickok did not write with his companion's intensity. He often stopped to listen to the questioning of a prospective juror, or to stare at the faces around him, particularly, and with plain displeasure, the muscular face of the county attorney, Duane West, who was his own age, 28. But his statement, written in a stylized script that looked like slanting rain, was finished before the court adjourned for the day. I will try to tell you all I can about myself, though most of my early life is vague to me, up until about my 10th birthday. My school years went quite the same as most other boys my own age. I had my share of fights, girls, and other things that go with a growing boy. My home life was also normal, but as I told you before, I was hardly ever allowed to leave my yard and visit with playmates. My father was always strict about us boys, his brother and him, in that line. Also, I had to help my dad quite a lot around the house. I can only remember my mother and dad having one argument that amounted to anything. What it was about, I don't know. My dad bought me a bicycle once, and I believe that I was the proudest boy in town. It was a girl's bike, and he changed it over to a boy's. He painted it all up, and it looked like new. But I had a lot of toys when I was little, a lot for the financial condition that my folks were in. We were always what you would call semi-poor. Never down and out, but several times on the verge of it. My dad was a hard worker and did his best to provide for us. My mother also was always a hard worker. Her house was always neat, and we had clean clothes aplenty. I remember my dad used to wear those old-fashioned flat-crown caps, and he would make me wear them too, and I didn't like them. In high school, I did real well. Made above-average grades the first year or two, but then started falling off a little. I had a girlfriend. She was a nice girl, and I never once tried to touch her anyway but just kissing. It was a real clean courtship. While in school, I participated in all the sports and received 9 letters in all. Basketball, football, track, and baseball. My senior year was best. I never had any steady girl, just played the field. That was when I had my first relationship with a girl. Of course, I told the boys that I'd had a lot of girls. I got offers from 2 colleges to play ball, but never attended any of them. After I graduated from school, I went to work for the Santa Fe Railroad and stayed until the following winter when I got laid off. The following spring, I got a job with the Rourke Motor Company. I had been working there about 4 months when I had an automobile wreck with a company car. I was in the hospital several days with extensive head injuries. While I was in the condition I was in, I couldn't find another job, so I was unemployed most of the winter. Meantime, I had met a girl and fallen in love. Her dad was a Baptist preacher and resented me going with her. In July, we were married. All hell broke loose from her dad until he learned she was pregnant. But still, he never wished me good luck, and that has always gone against the grain. After we were married, I worked at a service station near Kansas City. I worked from 8 at night till 8 in the morning. Sometimes my wife stayed with me all night. She was afraid I couldn't keep awake, so she came to help me. Then I got an offer to work at Perry Pontiac, which I gladly accepted. It was very satisfactory, though I didn't make a lot of money, $75 a week. I got along good with the other men and was well-liked by my boss. I worked there 5 years. During my employment there was the beginning of some of the lowest things I have ever done. Here Hickok revealed his pedophiliac tendencies, and after describing several sample experiences, wrote, "I know it is wrong. But at the time, I never give any thought to whether it is right or wrong. The same with stealing. It seems to be an impulse. One thing I never told you about the clutter deal is this. Before I ever went to their house, I knew there would be a girl there. I think the main reason I went there was not to rob them, but to rape the girl. Because I thought a lot about it. That is one reason why I never wanted to turn back when we started to. Even when I saw there was no safe. I did make some advances toward the Clutter Girl when I was there, but Perry never gave me a chance. I hope no one finds this out but you, as I haven't even told my lawyer. There were other things I should have told you, but I'm afraid of my people finding them out. Because I am more ashamed of them, these things I did, than hanging. I have had sickness. I think caused from the car wreck I had. Spells of passing out, and sometimes I would hemorrhage at the nose and left ear. I had one at some people's house by the name of Christ. They lived south of my parents. Not long ago, I had a piece of glass work out of my head. It came out the corner of my eye. My dad helped me to get it out. I figure I should tell you the things that led to my divorce and things that caused me to go to prison. It started the early part of 1957. My wife and I were living in an apartment in Kansas City. I had quit my job at the automobile company and went into the garage business for myself. I was renting the garage from a woman who had a daughter-in-law named Margaret. I met this girl one day while I was at work, and we went to have a cup of coffee. Her husband was away in the Marine Corps. To make a long story short, I started going out with her. My wife sued for divorce. I began thinking I never really loved my wife, because if I had, I wouldn't have done all the things I'd done. So I never fought the divorce. I started drinking and was drunk for almost a month. I neglected my business, spent more money than I earned, wrote bad checks, and in the end, became a thief. For this last, I was sent to the penitentiary. My lawyer said I should be truthful with you as you can help me. And I need help, as you know. The next day, Wednesday, was the proper start of the trial. It was also the first time ordinary spectators were admitted into the courtroom, an area too small to accommodate more than a modest percentage of those who applied at the door. The best seats had been reserved for 20 members of the press and for such special personages as Hickok's parents and Donald Cullivan, who, at the request of Perry Smith's lawyer, had traveled from Massachusetts to appear as a character witness in behalf of his former army friend. It had been rumored that the two surviving Clutter daughters would be present. They were not, nor did they attend any subsequent session. The family was represented by Mr. Clutter's younger brother Arthur, who had driven 100 miles to be there. He told newsmen, "I just want to get a good look at them," Smith and Hickok. "I just want to see what kind of animals they are. The way I feel, I could tear them apart." He took a seat directly behind the defendants and fixed them with a gaze of unique persistence, as though he planned to paint their portraits from memory. Presently, and it was as if Arthur Clutter had willed him to do it, Perry Smith turned and looked at him, and recognized a face very like the face of the man he had killed. The same mild eyes, narrow lips, firm chin. Perry, who was chewing gum, stopped chewing. He lowered his eyes. A minute elapsed, then slowly his jaws began to move again. Except for this moment, Smith and Hickok, too, affected a courtroom attitude that was simultaneously uninterested and disinterested. They chewed gum and tapped their feet with languid impatience as the state summoned its first witness. Nancy Ewalt. And after Nancy, Susan Kidwell. The young girls described what they saw upon entering the Clutter house on Sunday, November 15th. The quiet rooms, an empty purse on a kitchen floor, sunshine in a bedroom, and their schoolmate, Nancy Clutter, surrounded by her own blood. The defense waived cross-examination, a policy they pursued with the next three witnesses, Nancy Ewalt's father, Clarence, and Sheriff Earl Robinson, and the county coroner, Dr. Robert Fenton, each of whom added to the narrative of events that sunny November morning. The discovery, finally, of all four victims, and accounts of how they looked, and from Dr. Fenton, a clinical diagnosis of why. Severe traumas to brain and vital cranial structures inflicted by a shotgun. Then Richard G. Rohleder took the stand. Rohleder is chief investigator of the Garden City Police Department. His hobby is photography, and he is good at it. It was Rohleder who took the pictures that, when developed, revealed Hickok's dusty footprints in the clutter cellar, prints the camera could discern, though not the human eye. And it was he who had photographed the corpses, those death scene images Alvin Dewey had continuously pondered while the murders were still unsolved. The point of Rohleder's testimony was to establish the fact of his having made these pictures, which the prosecution proposed to put into evidence. But Hickok's attorney objected. The sole reason the pictures are being introduced is to prejudice and inflame the minds of the jurors. Judge Tate overruled the objection and allowed the photographs into evidence, which meant they must be shown to the jury. While this was being done, Hickok's father, addressing a journalist seated near him, said, "The judge up there, I never seen a man so prejudiced. Just no sense having a trial. Not with him in charge. Why, that man was a pallbearer at the funeral." Actually, Tate was but slightly acquainted with the victims and was not present at their funeral in any capacity. But Mr. Hickok's was the only voice raised in an exceedingly silent courtroom. Altogether, there were 17 prints, and as they were passed from hand to hand, the jurors' expressions reflected the impact the pictures made. One man's cheeks reddened as if he had been slapped, and a few, after the first distressing glance, obviously had no heart for the task. It was as though the photographs had prized open their mind's eye and forced them to at last really see the true and pitiful thing that had happened to a neighbor and his wife and children. It amazed them. It made them angry, and several of them, the pharmacist, the manager of the bowling alley, stared at the defendants with total contempt. The elder Mr. Hickok, wearily wagging his head, again and again murmured, "No sense. Just no sense having a trial." As the day's final witness, the prosecution had promised to produce a mystery man. It was the man who had supplied the information that led to the arrest of the accused, Floyd Wells, Hickok's former cellmate. Because he was still serving a sentence at Kansas State Penitentiary and therefore was in danger of retaliation from other inmates, Wells had never been publicly identified as the informer. Now, in order that he might safely testify at the trial, he had been removed from the prison and lodged in a small jail in an adjacent county. Nevertheless, Wells' passage across the courtroom toward the witness stand was oddly stealthy, as though he expected to encounter an assassin along the way. And as he walked past Hickok, Hickok's lips writhed as he whispered a few atrocious words. Wells pretended not to notice. But like a horse that has heard the hum of a rattlesnake, he shied away from the betrayed man's venomous vicinity. Taking the stand, he stared straight ahead, a somewhat chinless little farm boyish fellow wearing a very decent dark blue suit which the state of Kansas had bought for the occasion. The state being concerned that its most important witness should look respectable and consequently trustworthy. Wells' testimony, perfected by pretrial rehearsal, was as tidy as his appearance. Encouraged by the sympathetic promptings of Logan Green, the witness acknowledged that he had once, for approximately a year, worked as a hired hand at River Valley Farm. He went on to say that some 10 years later, following his conviction on a burglary charge, he had become friendly with another imprisoned burglar, Richard Hickok, and had described to him the Clutter Farm and family. "Now," Green asked, "during your conversations with Mr. Hickok, what was said about Mr. Clutter by either of you?"
"Well, we talked quite a bit about Mr. Clutter. Hickok said he was about to be paroled, and he was going to go west looking for a job. He might stop to see Mr. Clutter to get a job. I was telling him how wealthy Mr. Clutter was. Did that seem to interest Mr. Hickok?" Well, he wanted to know if Mr. Clutter had a safe around there. Mr. Wells, did you think at the time there was a safe in the Clutter house? Well, it has been so long since I worked out there. I thought there was a safe. I knew there was a cabinet of some kind. The next thing I knew, Hickok was talking about robbing Mr. Clutter. Did he tell you anything about how he was going to commit the robbery? He told me if he'd done anything like that, he wouldn't leave no witnesses. Did he actually say what he was going to do with the witnesses? Yes. He told me he would probably tie them up and then rob them and then kill them. Having established premeditation of great degree, Green left the witness to the ministrations of the defense. Old Mr. Fleming, a classic country lawyer more happily at home with land deeds than ill deeds, opened the cross-examination. The intent of his queries, as he soon established, was to introduce a subject the prosecution had emphatically avoided, the question of Wells' own role in the murder plot and his own moral liability. You didn't, Fleming said, hastening to the heart of the matter, say anything at all to Mr. Hickok to discourage him from coming out here to rob and kill the Clutter family. No. Anybody tells you anything about that up there, Kansas State Penitentiary, you don't pay any attention to it because you think they are just talking anyway. You mean you talked that way and didn't mean anything? Didn't you mean to convey to him, Hickok, the idea that Mr. Clutter had a safe? You wanted Mr. Hickok to believe that, did you not? In his quiet way, Fleming was giving the witness a rough time. Wells plucked at his tie, as though the knot was suddenly too tight. And you meant for Mr. Hickok to believe that Mr. Clutter had a lot of money, didn't you? I told him Mr. Clutter had a lot of money, yes. Fleming once more elicited an account of how Hickok had fully informed Wells of his violent plans for the Clutter family. Then, as though veiled in a private grief, the lawyer wistfully said, "And even after all of that, you did nothing to discourage him?" "I didn't believe he'd do it." "You didn't believe him? Then why? When you heard about the thing that happened out here, why did you think he was the one that was guilty?" Wells cockily replied, "Because it was done just like he said he was going to do." Harrison Smith, the younger half of the defense team, took charge. Assuming an aggressive, sneering manner that seemed forced, for really he is a mild and lenient man, Smith asked the witness if he had a nickname. "No. I just go by Floyd." The lawyer snorted. "Don't they call you Squealer now? Or do they call you Snitch?" "I just go by Floyd," Wells repeated, rather hangdog. "How many times have you been in jail?" "About 3 times. Some of those times for lying, were they?" Denying it, the witness said that once he'd gone to jail for driving without an operator's license, that burglary was the reason for his second incarceration, and the third, a 90-day hitch in an army stockade, had been the outcome of something that happened while he was a soldier. "We was on a train trip, guard. We got a little intoxicated on the train. Done a little extra shooting at some windows and lights." Everyone laughed. Everyone except the defendants. Hickok spat on the floor, and Harrison Smith, who now asked Wells why, after learning of the Holcomb tragedy, he had tarried several weeks before telling the authorities what he knew. "Weren't you," he said, "waiting for something to come out? Maybe like a reward?" "No." "You didn't hear anything about a reward?" The lawyer was referring to the reward of $1,000 that had been offered by the Hutchinson News for information resulting in the arrest and conviction of the Clutter murderers. "I seen it in the paper." "That was before you went to the authorities, wasn't it?" And when the witness admitted that this was true, Smith triumphantly continued by asking, "What kind of immunity did the county attorney offer you for coming up here today and testifying?" But Logan Green protested.
We object to the form of the question, Your Honor. There's been no testimony about immunity to anybody.
The objection was sustained and the witness dismissed. As he left the stand, Hickok announced to everyone within earshot,
Son of a bitch.
Anybody ought to hang, he ought to hang.
Look at him.
Gonna walk out of here and get that money and go scot-free.
This prediction proved correct, for not long afterward Wells collected both the reward and a parole. But his good fortune was short-lived. He was soon in trouble again, and over the years has experienced many vicissitudes. At present he is a resident of the Mississippi State Prison in Parchman, Mississippi, where he is serving a 30-year sentence for armed robbery. By Friday, when the court recessed for the weekend, the state had completed its case, which included the appearance of four special agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation in Washington, D.C. These men, laboratory technicians skilled in various categories of scientific crime detection, had studied the physical evidence connecting the accused to the murders. Blood samples, footprints, cartridge shells, rope, and tape. And each of them certified the validity of the exhibits. Finally, the four KBI agents provided accounts of interviews with the prisoners and of the confessions eventually made by them. In cross-examining the KBI personnel, the defense attorneys, a beleaguered pair, argued that the admissions of guilt had been obtained by improper means. Brutal interrogation in sweltering, brightly lighted, closet-like rooms. The allegation, which was untrue, irritated the detectives into expounding very convincing denials. Later, in reply to a reporter who asked him why he had dogged this artificial scent at such length, Hickok's lawyer snapped, "What am I supposed to do? Hell, I'm playing without any cards. But I can't just sit here like a dummy. I've got to sound off once in a while." The prosecution's most damaging witness proved to be Alvin Dewey. His testimony, the first public rendering of the events detailed in Perry Smith's confession, earned large headlines. Unveil mute murder horror. Cold, chilling facts told. And shocked his listeners. None more so than Richard Hickok, who came to a startled and chagrined attention when, in the course of Dewey's commentary, the agent said, "There is one incident Smith related to me that I haven't as yet mentioned." And that was that after the Clutter family was tied up, Hickok said to him how well-built he thought Nancy Clutter was, and that he was going to rape her. Smith said he told Hickok there wasn't going to be anything like that go on. Smith told me he had no respect for anyone who couldn't control their sexual desires, and that he would have fought Hickok before allowing him to rape the Clutter girl. Heretofore, Hickok had not known that his partner had informed police of the proposed assault. Nor was he aware that, in a friendlier spirit, Perry had altered his original story to claim that he alone had shot the four victims, a fact revealed by Dewey as he neared the end of his testimony. Perry Smith told me he wished to change two things in the statement he had given us. He said everything else in that statement was true and correct, except these two things. And that was that he wanted to say he killed Mrs. Clutter and Nancy Clutter, not Hickok. He told me that Hickok didn't want to die with his mother thinking he had killed any members of the Clutter family. And he said the Hickoks were good people. So why not have it that way? Hearing this, Mrs. Hickok wept. Throughout the trial, she had sat quietly beside her husband, her hands worrying a rumpled handkerchief. As often as she could, she caught her son's eye, nodded at him, and simulated a smile which, though flimsily constructed, affirmed her loyalty. But clearly the woman's control was exhausted. She began to cry. A few spectators glanced at her and glanced away, embarrassed. The rest seemed oblivious of the raw dirge counterpointing Dewey's continuing recitation. Even her husband, perhaps because he believed it unmanly to take notice, remained aloof. At last, a woman reporter, the only one present, led Mrs. Hickok out of the courtroom and into the privacy of a ladies' room. Once her anguish had subsided, Mrs. Hickok expressed a need to confide.
"There's nobody much I can talk to," she told her companion. "I don't mean people haven't been kind, neighbors and all.